So Mary Wollstonecraft was born in 1759. Her grandfather, it seems, had been a wealthy Irish manufacturer, but she was born to a less than happy couple, of which her father was fairly unstable and sometimes, it seems, rather violent. It may be the experience of that family life that determined her to find independence for herself, to make her own way in the world. Because something that characterised her entire life is this desire to find a position for an independent woman in a society that really did not think women should be independent in many ways at all. Early on, she experiments with setting up a school. She moves to North London. She's taken in and encouraged by the community of dissenters who lived in North London. Dissenters are non-conformists, people outside the Church of England, tended to have a progressive view on life, were looking for reform in politics, tended to have, relatively speaking, a more tolerant attitude to ideas of female education. The school doesn't work at first, and eventually she has to take up a position as governess to an aristocratic family in Ireland. Goes very well at first. People are very charmed by her sparkling and lively personality, but starts to go wrong when it seems she starts to encourage the eldest daughter to think in the kind of independent way. She comes back to London. She's again encouraged by members of the dissenting community in North London, and especially the publisher Joseph Johnson, who finds her somewhere to live, takes her on effectively as a staff writer for his periodical, The Analytical Review, which is an important source of knowledge for Wollstonecraft, because working as a reviewer then, she's kind of having contact with the latest books, not just published in England, but actually from throughout Europe. She starts to write primarily educational books, which Johnson publishes. They're all marked by a relatively liberal attitude. The really big event, though, in Wollstonecraft's life, I think, is the outbreak of the French Revolution in 1789. She ends up living in revolutionary France for 2 or 3 years when it was very, very difficult for English people to be there. While still in London, she's one of the earliest respondents to Edmund Burke's conservative attacks on the French Revolution and his reflections on the revolution in France of 1790. Only a matter of weeks after Burke's book comes out, she brings out her first vindication, a vindication of the rights of men, which it gives a very powerful response to Burke, which the conservative press immediately regards as the exercising of what it calls a masculine intelligence, because she's dealing with issues that are seen as men's issues. Nevertheless, the overall response at that stage to that book is quite positive. It's seen as being a bravura performance, a powerful performance. 2 years later, in 1792, she brings out A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, basically looking at what it means for a woman to exist in a freer society, still with actually with an educational emphasis, what would be a proper education for women, arguing that women need to be taught as rational beings, not just the playthings of men, but also interested actually in what a republican mother would be, arguing that, you know, if society, a republican society, especially in her mind, is going to thrive, then the women are going to be its mothers, will have to be strong and rational individuals. Very soon after the book comes out, she goes to see for herself what's happening in France. She remains there until early 1795. But while she's there, she meets and falls in love with an American adventurers, it's hard not to call him anything else, Gilbert Imlay, a man, as many Americans obviously had, of Republican sympathies, but also somebody actually who's trying to make money out of the turmoil in Europe. He seems to have had a lot of things going on, including being involved in a trade of breaking the British blockade, naval blockade against revolutionary France, by shipping French silver, aristocratic silver, out to neutral countries, as the Scandinavian countries were, and then bringing back corn for the revolution. Not out of, I don't think, any selfless commitment to the revolution, but trying to make a profit both ways. It's the loss of a shipment of that silver that sends Wollstonecraft off to Scandinavia on her intrepid journey. Soon after, by the way, she'd attempted suicide after discovering that Imlay had been unfaithful to her. And indeed, on her return, she finds out that Imlay has again taken up with another woman and again tries to kill herself by throwing herself off Putney Bridge. However, she's nursed to recovery by those same dissenting friends and by another woman writer, Mary Hayes, who was somebody who was always impressed by the example of Wollstonecraft. And through Hayes, she meets the philosopher William Godwin, who had responded very positively to letters written in Sweden, Norway and Denmark, but had also actually, in his radical book, Political Justice, written against marriage and even cohabitation. Nevertheless, they end up marrying and cohabiting to a degree. Godwin always kept a kind of separate establishment for writing and socialising. And eventually, Mary gets pregnant and she gives birth to the future Mary Shelley. Giving birth, Wollstonecraft is infected, and although various doctors are brought in to try and save her, she dies from the infection. Godwin very quickly, perhaps too quickly, brings out a memoir of his wife detailing a lot of the vicissitudes of her life, including the relationship with Imlay and the birth of the illegitimate Fanny, who she takes to Norway. And this is seized upon eagerly by the conservative press. And for many years afterwards, she is held up as the hyena in petticoats, as one writer called her, as an example of what it is to be an unsexed female. And her death is understood as the kind of punishment that fate metes out to women who try and step beyond their natural sphere.